Jerry sets a table and he lays a feast. There the mighty gonna serve the least.
So bend and cut,
one for my woman.
Bend and cut,
one for my lord.
Bend and cut,
one to pay my credit.
Bend and cut,
at the factory store.
Bend and cut,
one for the big house.
Bend and cut,
and the next again.
Bend and cut,
one to buy my ticket.
Bend and cut,
all the bills.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on remote with Robert Earl Price, award-winning poet, playwright, and screenwriter. And we came in with some of his original work. Robert, hi, how are you?
I'm great, Grace, how are you?
Well, this is a grand experiment, Robert Earl. Tell us what we just heard coming in. Red Devil Moon, what is this that you have created?
Well, Red Devil Moon is a musical. And what you heard was from a concert version of that musical that was created by Pam Ortiz, the lyricist, and myself, who wrote the book for the play. The play is an adaptation of a portion of a seminal novel from the Harlem Renaissance by Jean Toomer called Cain. And it depicts life in South Georgia in 1920 as the Great Migration was in full force. And those who don't know, the Great Migration was that period from the early 1900s up until the 60s, I would say, when African Americans left the South in droves. At least 6 million of them moved north for better work and better living conditions.
Well, I feel that you're a historian as well as a poet, and we are grateful to you for your work, because these things would not be known today, Robert Earl. That's the problem. I mean, I think in the classroom, we will read Jean Toomer, but I don't think that it's as prevalent as it was when we were in school.
I agree. I don't think that a lot of history slips through the cracks. The other thing is that the history that does exists in the school is often so pedantic, or so you must remember the date to the exact second or something, that it doesn't really relate the human story. I tell students frequently that sometimes the poets get it right, or as right as the historians.
Oh yes, I agree.
We can start with the Iliad and come forward, just dealing with the Western canon, and come to the conclusion that I know more about the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere from Longfellow than I do from any history book.
That is such a good example. Well, I would like the audience to hear a poem by Robert Earl Price, because I think you have 4 books out, right?
Yes, and a new one coming out this year, a 5th one.
Yes, so they're entitled Bloodlines, Blood Elegy, Blues Blood, and Wise Blood. And the 5th book is Blood Flow. So let's hear a poem. Robert Earl Price, this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress on remote.
Okay, well, before we get too much into the history, maybe a lighter poem, a poem about daydreams. Daydreams. There are days when it hurts to stay and I'm afraid to go, so I crawl around the closets of myself trying to remember where I stashed the plans. There are days when all my words are dangerous and all of my actions offend. So I move about on tiptoe and trembled when I speak. When best intentions turn to ashes and every thought draws blood, my past mistakes sit outside the door and snicker when I come and go. There are days when my friends and my enemies don the same uniforms, play the same games, trap me in the backcourt with no one to pass to. There are days when radio and telephone collaborate their lives, and I discover that loneliness has keys to all my doors. but there are moments, moments so pure and promised filled that on most days I suffer sweet amnesia and will dream on a moment's notice.
Robert Earl Price, that is beautiful and a very nice one to begin with, because we're both in quarantine, but we have our daydreams.
Yes.
And the poet will keep us out of the mud of civilization. The poet will always raise us up, as you will. Now, you've had quite a career, and you've had plays in Europe, in Berlin, in Johannesburg. Tell us how that happened, and were you able to attend?
Yes. Well, first of all, how it happened. I did not set out to be a playwright. I set out to be a great American novelist, and for years resisted all other approaches. I thought I was going to be a great American novelist, and that's sort of the way I prepared myself, by telling stories and trying to retain some history. But what happened is, after getting a degree in film, I realized that I had to return to Atlanta, which is not a... And working for a while in Hollywood, I returned to Atlanta, which is not a film town. So I said, well, theater's next. So I tried theater and was instantly gratified by it because of the quick feedback and the smaller budgets required to mount a play when you compare them to the Hollywood. So it was just an easier game, and Atlanta was a return home. I had to return home to see about my mom.
Oh, so you're from Georgia. You're from Georgia.
I'm from Atlanta, yes. Uh-huh. So when I left Atlanta, a segregated place, there was no work for me. When I returned, there was work that I could do in theater there. I could continue to write poetry. And so I went back to Atlanta for... a long time, and developed a lot of plays there in Atlanta. Found a beautiful theater, Seven Stages, a small theater with an international reputation. And they liked the work. The work was a little different from what was normally coming out of Georgia. And so we had an opportunity to take the work to a lot of places, including, as you mentioned, Johannesburg in South Africa and Berlin.
What is the title of one of your plays?
Well, one of my plays is called Blue Monk, and it looks at the life of, or it looks at an aspect of the great jazz composer Thelonious Monk.
Oh, man, would I love to see that. What was your other play?
Well, I've done several.
I think you've done, like, how many have you produced? I think 11, right?
Well, it's now 12. I did a short one last year called The Unlading. Which play? Oh, you asked me about the Berlin play was Yardbird's Vamp, which is about Charlie Parker, of course.
Oh, this is so great that you have immortalized these great musicians. We should have these plays produced again. We need them so much.
I would love, well, you know, some, now and then we try to mount them. The Charlie Parker play, I was lucky because there were so many expatriate jazz musicians in Berlin. That was one of the places that reproduced it. And some of them are musicians that I know. I am a jazz head, or, you know, in my next life, I want to be a jazz musician. I know a lot of jazz musicians. In fact, one of my favorite photographs is from Berlin, where the group that we played with there, the band, was playing at a place called the A-Train, and they have the band listed, and they allowed me to read poetry in front of the musicians, and the sign reads, on vocals, Robert Earl Price. Of course, I'm no singer.
That is great. But poetry is a form of vocalization.
Sure.
And so let's have a station break here while you read a poem. Robert Earl Price from Chestertown, Maryland. And he is filling the world with what it needs. Let's hear a poem.
Okay. Ugly beauty for the American clipper ships. Such works of wonder, anchored to such tawdry deeds. Sea kites, elegant blends of air and speed. Sea kites trail in a putrid aroma the savage scent of greed. They fled Lawanda, all sails set, a swoosh of grace, a Baltimore clipper fleeing that heathen place. Blockade warships pretended to give chase, although none could keep a pace with American ingenuity and its swoosh of flowing grace. Oh, they fled the Gold Coast scudding, gunwales near a flooding, fishes feasting on their chum, bodies bloating in their wake, and from below a tight-packed human hum, a song so soundly wrought that far-off whales and dolphins took note. And when the heavens heard the song, the cargo wrote, a swirling wind taunted sailors in the rigging, and from the binge below, a taunted humming moan. Oh, you should have heard them moan, jamming, the middle passage groan. Such a work of wonder, anchored to such a tawdry deed. Sea kites, elegant blends of air and speed. Sea kites trailing a putrid aroma, the savage scent of greed. They left Lawanda, laden, a cargo of breathing gold, sardined humans stacked in the hold, trailing a salt, bleached bones all along the way. 50 million left Angola, sold and betrayed, aboard a ship of bondage, under a sail of cloud, a village uprooted and set adrift, a familiar night stolen by the shifting sky, a starred bridge from Southern Cross to Drinking Gourd, a swift sea change into someone else's somewhere else, after or before the haunting, the humming, a name, a headless man, a child, a life casually tossed overboard. For every 100 sold, 40 more lighten the load. On such a ship of beauty, linked to such an ugly deed, shackled people inside a swoosh of grace and speed. Auctioneers waiting for Charleston's holding pens, waiting for the clipper ships unlading and the bidding to begin. Builders and outfitters all along the way, divvying up their shares of the clipper ship pay. Beauty skipping over the foaming waves, its hold crammed with humming slaves. One part is profit means another party's pain, playing jazzy contradictions in a profit margin game, with freedom and fairness still on the lam, a blue moaning swoosh vamping on an ugly beauty jam, a blued humming swoosh vamping on an ugly beauty jam.
Whoa, Robert Earl Price, that is terrible and beautiful. I love the way you mix the beauty of the images with the horror beneath them.
Well, you know, every fall, autumn, here in Chestertown, Maryland, where I currently live, they have down rigging where they take the ships out of the water or store them for the winter or secure them for the winter. And there's a ceremony. And every year they sail up the Chester River, these beautiful sailing boats, the one from Baltimore. There's one here in Chestertown called the Sultana. And they are absolutely gorgeous. And I look at them and I go, oh, how beautiful they are. But then I remember these ships were designed to outrun the slave blockades. Their swiftness and their grace was also a mechanism for speeding slaves away from Africa to here.
That's why we need you, Robert Earl Price, because you take the present day and put it in the context that we need to see. That is what the poet does, and that is why we thank you so much. I know that you worked with Alex Haley. I wonder if our audience even knows who that is. Remind us who Alex Haley is, and then tell us your relationship with him.
Okay. Alex Haley was from Henning, Tennessee, and he is the author of Roots, one of the most widely watched television programs ever known, and Roots is an internationally acclaimed novel.
Right.
He won a Pulitzer for it, and I'm not sure if he won a National Book Award. At any rate, My first visit to Alex was in his office, and he had this huge office, and one entire wall was covered with books, shelves of books and books and books and books. It must have been thousands of, at least hundreds of them. And I looked at every book, and every book was a copy of Roots. It was Roots in Chinese and paperback, in Vietnamese and hardcover. You know, it was just incredible to see all of those different translations of Roots, and you know, that this one man had created. But his fame for Roots overshadows the fact that he is the writer of the autobiography of Malcolm X. And so Alex and I, for a few weeks, worked together on a television program called Palmerstown, USA. I wrote a few episodes for it. At any rate, during that period, I used to talk with Alex about how long the autobiography of Malcolm X was. It's about 500 pages. And I was going, you know, you can't get the African-American community to read, to pick up a book like that and read it. You've got to do something else. And his response to me was, well, you're the poet. You make it shorter. So in one of my earlier books, I have written a short, well, it's not a short poem, but I've written a long poem that tries to convince the autobiography of Malcolm X.
Did he like it?
He did. But he was a great guy. He was great fun to be with, and we had shared some other things. You know, we had other things in common. He had been in the Coast Guard, I had been in the Air Force, and while there, we had both written love letters for our fellow soldiers.
Oh.
So he had made money writing love letters to women he'd never met, and I had done the same thing for people, for strangers.
What a profession. What a profession. That is great. Robert Earl Price. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. However, we are on remote. And so let's hear another poem, Robert Earl.
Well, so much has happened in the recent days that New Year's Eve 2019, or right before 2020, seems a long way away. But I every year here in Chestertown, I throw a New Year's Eve party and invite poets and artists and everybody to read. And here's the poem I wrote for this year, not knowing what was to come. On the eve of a new year, tonight on the rim of a new day, I am a griot from the patchwork dimension, a fable cobbled from lies and dreams, a song that I cannot sing, a dance that cannot be repeated until sweet wines loosen my restraints, and my pain is not a river of black veils snaking across the mourner's bench, a tombstone in every bowed head. Tonight is the ultimate midnight when promise and precipice kiss astride the threshold of now or next. Regret sting my eyes, and I remember Miles Davis bleeding over the edge of a stage and someone ordering another drink, oblivious to the tinkling chill of hearing the unspeakable quilted into sound. A breathing oath that swears that someday something beautiful will come to pass. Sometimes I dance naked in an herb-fragrant room as a tribute to the goddess of freedom. Sometimes I dance naked in a sweetly scented room as a tribute to the luscious flower beckoning me to her bed, and my pain is not a river of black veil snaking across the mourner's bench, a tombstone in every bowed head. Tonight I stand in tomorrow's doorway, my tongue driven by a hummingbird's flutter, my stammering heart a ewer of falcon eyes. Monk has gone straight, no chaser. Mad monk, the dancing dervish gone straight, no chaser, no chaser, no bimshus swing to parade with the wild Indians along Bourbon Street. Only a spell cast with bloodless bones. My fear of sanctioned restraints are too many to name or number. My ignorance leaves me sane. My ignorance drives me mad. I want you to know that midnight holds the formula for fiery neutron undiscovered tempos. Merry is the moment that we dance. Merry are the times when pain is not a river of black veils snaking across the mourner's bench, a tombstone in every bowed head. Magically, I am still here, breathing the sterling starlight. A cowrie shell rattle and a horsehair whisk charms to clear a path for an ankled bell dancer. Hope squirming in my clenched fist, it lures me into tomorrow, and tomorrow into me, where I regret the need to run a race, too often run, or list all of the things that I never intended to do again. Tonight at midnight I will raise my glass and lean into tomorrow, where my pain is not yet a river of black veils snaking across the mourner's bench, not yet a rock on the shoulder of my joy. When the next year looms, I cling to the dregs of times past and shudder at times yet to come. Then I silently chant the words of that great prophet Charlie Parker, who said, "Now's the time. Time, the now's the time, 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 now's the time." The thought calms me, and I become a dropping ball, cocooned in the tiny crevice that divides what was from what will be. Happy New Year.
Ah, that was a masterwork. Now, did you write that all in one sitting, Robert Earl?
Well, sort of.
It flows. You know, it flows like liquid gold. And people don't know why it flows, but I can hear the alliterations, the repetitions, the vowels. I can hear the ing words, the muscle that moves it forward. Did you put that together, or did you write that in a piece?
Well, with me always, it's a combination. First, there is the flush of the inspiration or the idea, the kernel of the idea, and some of the lines, usually with me. And I walk around and fiddle with those, finally write a draft, and then the work begins. And the work is, of course, as you said, to combine the right form of syllables, to put some music into it, to try to find a cadence for it, to try to find images that aren't images you can predict before the poet reads them, those kind of things. That's where the work begins.
Well, clearly you are influenced from music and of music and by music. That is so much in your work. It is music making. So let us have a final poem.
Okay. I write a lot of occasional poems. Poems that, how shall I say, poems that remember a certain day or a certain time. I'm living in a very small town now, and so for years now, people have been asked, for every year, people ask me to write a King Day poem. And so I've collected four or five King Day poems, and I'd like to read you the one from 2020. It's called "Living in a Burning House." And I don't usually use epigraphs, but I have an epigraph here that says, quote, and a note. The quote: "When you are forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait." End quote. Dr. Martin Luther King, letter from a Birmingham jail. Now here's the note. Entertainer and political activist Harry Belafonte quotes a disheartened Dr. King weeks before his assassination as having said, "I fear I am integrating my people into a burning house." The poem, "Nobody in a Burning House." Reverend King's fading dreams hides the banked flames of racial genocide, smoldering, waiting to reignite. We celebrate his birth, but rarely his assassination. We have chosen assimilation as the path to somebodyness, but that path leads into a burning house where the flames of nobodyness lick at the ebony core of our better self. Nobodies blooming in a hothouse, bleaching cream salesmen peeling our skin, blind justice supplying prison inventory, wrong place, wrong people, wrong time, wrong way, wrong skin, wrong. If this were a Sunday morning gospel, I would shout, stomp my foot, and testify, because I've been buked and scorned and left without a place to be somebody. We live outside thinly veiled sadness, fading snapshots of somebodyness slipping into darkness, a postcard from Linton stapled to a wall somewhere. If this were a blues song, I would moan. I would moan because there are no words to describe the hocus pocus of converting grace and gumption into nobodiness. Colored folks cast as stand-ins for someone else. We grow weak and weary from the eternal flaking away of our own selfness, chips of nobodiness providing kindling fuel for the failing fantasy of privilege. Our king worried that he was leading brave, generous people into the flames, wearing shrouds of nobodiness. Folks from the stopped and frisked tribe, flotsam from the gentrified gutters of our blood soaked, offered as gasoline for the power and the glory of freedom. If this were an opera, the audience would burn like napalm tears. If this were a jazz composition, the solos would scream and growl, demanding ownership of our own selves. Slowly and deliberately, nobodiness cloaks the unfree in invisibility, nobodiness blending into the decor, smoke spiraling upward, swaying in time to the wind's eyes' song. This house is ablaze and we are trapped inside, hostages of suicidal arsonists pretending that Martin's dream will rescue us. Hostages of suicidal arsonists pretending that Martin's dream will rescue us.
The voice of Robert Earl Price. This is The Poet and the Poem on Remote. Production by Forest Woods Media. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipid Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.